Hello, this is the second podcast in a series about innovative research methods in criminology supported by the University of Hull and Research England's Enhancing Research Culture Fund. I'm Ian Brennan from the University of Hull, and today I'm joined by Professor Matthew Williams from Cardiff University. Matthew is Professor of Criminology and Director of the ESRC Data Science Lab and Director of the ESRC Hate Lab. Matthew, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Ian. Glad to be here.
So thanks very much for joining us. I today want to just talk about your career, but also talk about the sort of methods you're currently using as part of the Hate Lab and part of the ESRC Data Science Lab. So Matthew, we've known each other for quite a long time, but we haven't actually spoken in a decade, I guess. Could you tell us, for our listeners, a little bit just about your career path from undergrad into the position you're currently in?
Absolutely. Yeah. So I started out with a degree in sociology back in, I think it was 1993, 1994. And then from there, enjoyed the criminology elements of the program so much that I kind of enrolled to be an MSc student on their master's in criminology and criminal justice. So we had the likes of sort of Mike Levy, Mike McGuire sort of teaching on that master's, which is in itself an attraction because they're such big names in the field and they've got such great experience in their various fields of interest. And that got me hooked on criminology pretty much from that point onwards. And as sometimes happens, they were quite on the lookout for prospective PhD students to get on their program. And the kinds of ideas that I had for the master's at the time in terms of the dissertation drew their eye, I suppose, either for the right or the wrong reasons. But I was interested in understanding a bit about the intersection of the fear of crime and technology at the time and how new tech, in particular the internet, of course, this was around about 97 when it was becoming much more used in domestic circumstances, how new technology might disrupt or inform our understanding of anxiety and in particular fear of crime. And that was something then that carried on through to the PhD. So they were kind of encouraging and said, oh, you should think about doing a PhD. And that's where it went. And the PhD was in itself then a sort of an enhanced version of that interest in a way. It was me focusing in particular on how a particular online setting, it was a virtual world, a bit like, well, it was very a precursor to the metaverse, I suppose, is what we might call it now, with Meta's new incarnation of virtual reality. This was kind of non-virtual reality, but a 3D environment where folks could sort of wander around these interesting virtual environments in a graphical way. And I was particularly interested in how they would regulate deviance in this environment. So this is pre-social media. It was pre all this kind of Web 2 and obviously now Web 3 stuff. And it caught the attention of both mics, and they were like, "Yeah, we should definitely support this and put something together." And that's where I ended up kind of spending the 4 or 5 years doing the PhD. Then and then the rest is history in terms of the career, because I think at one point Mike McGuire in particular came up and said, "Oh, I've got this Home Office grant that means I'm going to be researching a lot, and would you do my teaching for me?" And I was like, "Yeah, great, I'll do your teaching for you." And then that's what my first lectureship was before the PhD ended, actually. And then I've been at Cardiff University since 1994, I think. And so kind of part of me thinks, well, does that make me a bit sad, because I've gone somewhere else? But
I can name several people at Cardiff who have spent their entire careers there. And both my PhD supervisors started at Cardiff and never left.
Yeah, it's a nice place. It's a nice little city. And once you start embedding, you're getting your family, you buy your first house, and it becomes harder and harder to move and uproot your life, doesn't it? So, but it's been good to me, and I'm grateful to have been able to forge my career here.
So the lectureship at Cardiff in the, early 2000s?
Yeah, it was 2001, which was, I started the lecture, being like a part-time lecturer in 2001. First proper job was 2004, I think, which is when I got in a proper interview, proper kind of job application and all that kind of stuff. That was when that's when Cardiff University recognizes I started as a proper employee. So yeah, it was from that point on then I carried on looking at this topic, but diversified slightly as well. So I kind of went more into how the internet was transforming certain kinds of criminal behavior. So cybercrime was sort of broadly what I was interested in. But then beyond that, I became particularly interested in the use of language online, threats and hate speech, which kind of ultimately led to where I am today. But you know, at the time, it was more sort of dabbling, because ultimately folks weren't paying that much attention to the internet. It wasn't, you know, the main concerns at the time, I think, were copyright infringement, which was a big thing, and the protection of minors in terms of sexual grooming. And there were lots of sort of policy initiatives, sort of national and supranational, but the European Union at the time, that were regulating those kinds of behaviors. That was the main concern. What the technology was really disrupting was, you know, this expansion of paedophile networks, or the ability for folks to connect to each other and share legal imagery, etc. And similarly with, you know, the protection of the big companies' IP in terms of music and movies and the duplication and production of that stuff. And, you know, those things weren't as interesting to me. But the stuff that was interesting was the kind of slowly emerging, you know, far right that were capitalizing on the internet, what they were doing and how it was changing their structures and dynamics and their recruiting patterns, and that's what particularly interested me. It took about 10 to 15 years, though, I think, for government to really consider it a problem in that sense. And yeah, ever since government did decide it was a problem, then I think that's when my career stepped up a gear, because that meant funding became available for this kind of work. Before that moment, I don't think the funding was very forthcoming. Actually, there were smaller grants. People didn't think it was much of a social problem, but the advent of social media, the kind of amplification of the problem since, you know, Twitter, Facebook, Google came onto the scene and, you know, were very kind of laissez-faire in their regulation of this content, which led us to this pretty messed up moment in time where, you know, hate speech is still in abundance and largely unregulated in parts of the world. And yeah, and this has meant that my career did change, and it shifted, you know, it ended up in allowing me to go for promotion maybe quicker than otherwise would have happened, and you know, it's led to a shift in how I work, in a sense. So I do more research than teaching now, mainly because there is more opportunity to do research because the funding is more available.
Was there a moment or an event where suddenly government or particularly funders and realized the enormity of this problem and sort of scrambled to get to you, or was this something more gradual?
It did seem like a moment, and I think it was around 2010-11. I think for a long time experts were lobbying government, you know, and the House of Lords actually, I think, was more receptive to these sort of arguments than the Commons was at the time, or whatever government was in power, I can't remember. But there were a few key reports that did come out, I remember, one of them from the House of Lords, that seemed to change things. It's interesting that it's taken this long to get an online safety bill through Parliament. I mean, it seems like that should have been done a long time ago. And the perspective up to the point where there was a decision that was being made on whether or not we should have a separate piece of legislation was that most of our existing laws were fine to cope with this new form of deviant activity, because they were written in a technology-neutral way. So it didn't matter if there was a new company or a new technology that was doing something. Our technology-neutral laws, the way they were written, could be adapted, and we could deal with that just through changes to existing legislation. But I think we eventually got to a point where that just didn't make much sense. And ultimately, I think the Online Safety Bill, which may be delayed now, it not only kind of addresses some of these problems, not in a satisfactory way, I would add, but ultimately it's a form of communication. Like most laws and acts of Parliament, they also have a function of communicating to to citizens that, you know, we're looking at this and taking this seriously. And I think very often the fact that we know that something is being done is in itself solving part of the problem. But yeah, there was a, I think it was about 2010, 11 when I saw a distinct shift in how government departments began to address the problem. And subsequently, there have been moments whereby, for example, I think certainly after Cambridge Analytica, that really raised the profile of the issue like nothing else ever has. I think the idea that, you know, the notion that tech companies could influence the outcomes of elections, for example, that certainly got the attention of politicians. And that was definitely a key moment in time where government departments completely changed their response, and academics like myself got a bit busier because there was a lot more interested in listening to what we had to say beyond that point.
When you started out researching sort of hate online and the far right, what sort of back in like early 2000s, what sort of platforms were they using and how did those evolve?
So I guess one of the first far-right organizations to use the internet was the Stormfront website. They were the first to capitalize on technology. There was a discussion within their ranks about, you know, what this internet thing was and how it might transform their ability to get their message out and to swell their membership. And there were a few key players within the organization who really, really pushed, some of the younger members really, really pushed for them to set up their websites and their kind of membership structure on the website. And I think they launched their website in the late 1990s and, you know, it swelled to over 300,000 members. And it did transform their capability to recruit, to get their message out and probably, you know, change minds for the worse. And once that, you know, acted as the first case study, then others began to mirror it with other kinds of similar sites. But really it was, you know, social media that changed everything in terms of just the ability for organizations, but individuals in particular as well, like Tommy Robinson would be an obvious one, to spread their message in a way that was not possible before the existence. I mean, websites, static websites, you know, you had to go to them, very difficult to kind of dynamically interact with your members apart from emailing them or a message board. But with social media, it just opened the kind of floodgates in a sense, and each communication, you know, could reach a much broader audience than ever before. And that's kind of the advent of Web 2, I suppose. And yeah, that was key and transformative, I think, for the far and alt-right and the extreme right. So when we started out, a lot of our research was on websites, you know, and discussion forums. So very kind of clunky, very manual approach to data collection, for example. So there's lots of cutting and pasting. I remember in my PhD, for example, I literally had to hover my mouse over a button on a website and then stick a piece of blue tack on the keyboard so the enter button was fastened down. I went for lunch, came back from lunch, and I had downloaded all of the forums posts, you know, and that was my first foray into online data collection. It was a piece of blue tack and a keyboard and you know, off to lunch I go and I come back and my data collection's complete. That was an interesting experience. Of course, it's a bit more technical than that these days, but you know, back then it was pretty manual in that sense, I suppose. These days it is a bit more technical than back then.
So it's the origins of web scraping was blue tech, like that.
For me, it was, as a social scientist. That says a lot more about me, I think, than the techniques available at the time. But that was my solution at the time.
So it was. It's still. So your analysis presumably was quite qualitative in nature, analyzing language and discourse.
Right? Yeah, sure. So at the time, the PhD, most of the data I collected was kind of either forum traffic, but also I set up a distribution email system whereby I could sort of ask questions to a group of folks that agreed to take part over a period of about 2 or 3 weeks. But it was like a virtual focus group, if you like. but it was like a discussion list essentially. And yeah, so it was all qualitative, which is I analyzed using, I think at the time, Atlas TI allowed me to sort of code it up and then present it thematically in a thesis. I mean, that said, I did meet an American during my studies. Her name is Amanda Robinson, now a professor at Cardiff, I know you're familiar with because you do similar work in the domestic violence field. And you know, American social scientists are, you know, for the most part, you know, quantitative. Their programs are quite quantitative, and she convinced me to run a crosstab on some quantitative data that I was able to get from within the virtual world I was looking at. There was this kind of peacekeeper force that they, a voluntary police force that kind of would patrol certain areas of this virtual world. And they would collect data on how many ejections that they made. And then they would sort of get some, I guess what you'd call like demographic data on the avatar. Were they visiting the site for the first time? Had they been around for a bit longer? And some other characteristics on their accounts. And I could kind of do a very simplistic, totally non-representative kind of analysis of eviction rates and certain characteristics. So that was my first foray into stats. And I, to be fair, I quite enjoyed it. I was like, oh, this is, maybe it made me kind of like feel like a proper social scientist, which would it's a terrible thing to say, because qualitative data is as important as quantitative data, and it really does depend on what your research question is. But ultimately, I just kind of felt, you know, wow, I've got this kind of result before my very eyes, you know, and it actually kind of made sense. And I was kind of, I took it into my supervisor, who was Paul Atkinson, you know, the godfather of ethnography, and I was kind of a bit anxious about what he was going to say, what this random crosstab popping up amongst this thematic analysis. But he was pretty receptive to it, to be fair, and he was like, well, you know, it adds to your argument, and you know, it's pretty interesting to see that you've got, and you know, I don't think at the time there was anything out there that had quite done what I had done, in the sense like actually get some online data from an online world and conduct an analysis like that. So he was pretty happy for me to leave it in there, and that was my first kind of exposure to quants, and I liked it. And ever since that point, you know, I exposed myself to more and more of it, working a bit more with Amanda on certain projects and learning along the way. So I'm not formally trained as such in quantitative methods. It's very much learning on the job, and the stuff that I've been doing more recently with machine learning and that kind of more computer science side of things is again, that's another example of learning on the job, but a very different kind of approach to data.
Could you tell us a little bit about that? So how did you, I suppose it's the advent of social media and Twitter that allows a sort of big data computational approach to be implemented. So could you just, for assuming the audience don't know anything about this, could you sort of summarize roughly what the approach is? And
yeah, I guess the key thing to understand is the nature of the data and how it differs from what social scientists are used to. So you're right in what you said earlier that, you know, a lot of the data we get is textual in orientation. So it's sort of written language. But there's so much of it, you know, whereas a social scientist who's interested in sort of interviewing some offenders or even doing a focus group, you know, they might generate 20, 30,000 words of data from a set of interviews or a focus group. But with social media, if you're collecting around an event, say, for example, you're interested in the social reaction online in the aftermath of a terror attack, then if you collect for, say, 24 hours after that attack, and the data you generate, you're talking about tens of millions, if not hundreds of millions, of words of data. And you simply cannot then analyze that by hand. Even if you had a team of coders, you know, 20, 30 coders, it would still take years and years to systematically code that stuff up in the traditional method. So we had to start sort of talking to computer scientists about how we deal with these volumes of textual data. And their answer is, as you might expect, is that, yeah, well, we'll just build a piece of software, an algorithm that kind of tries to mimic what a human does. So let's kind of, you know, instead of having human coders, we'll have a machine act as the coder, but we'll teach it how to behave like a human coder. I'm, of course, I'm like looking around the room thinking, this is crazy. What we're talking about, you know, how can we do this? And how can we ensure it's going to be doing the same kind of thing as a human? I mean, all these questions were kind of like swimming around in my head. And over time, I kind of learned that, you know, something called machine learning, which is very common, commonly used in industry by the big tech companies, and frequently used in computer science applications across all sorts of different domains, can be used to train an algorithm ultimately to mimic a human being or decision making in terms of what a human being might decide in a context. So what we do is essentially get a sample of those millions and millions of posts that we collect, say, after that terror attack. Get a bunch of human annotators, say, four humans, to then look at each of those tweets in that sample with a set of instructions asking them, for example, you know, is this post hateful or not? According to you, you know, we're relying on their judgment as a human being. So we're not giving them a technical definition of what is or what is not hateful. We're just saying, you know, thinking of you as an average person, would you consider this to be hateful if it's targeted a certain kind of person? And then we get all those four annotators to independently then annotate the data. Then we look at the inter-rater agreement between them. And if a post, say, has three out of four people agreeing that it's hateful, so 75%, we kind of say, well, right, we've got a broad agreement that this tweet, is generally regarded as hateful by the majority of humans who've seen it. Anything below that, we disregard and say, well, there's too much disagreement here, so we'll just dump that data and leave it to one side. So once we have this training data set, a bunch of tweets that are regarded as hateful as decided by a majority of human beings, and then a bunch of posts that agreed not to be hateful, we have a yes class and a no class. We're then able to give that to the machine and have it learn from the structure of speech in the hate speech sample versus the structure of speech in the non-hate speech sample. And there's lots of different algorithms you can apply. I mean, today there are hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of different algorithms you can use to kind of improve the performance of the algorithm. But ultimately, what the machine ends up doing is recognizing patterns in speech that are present in one sample but not present in another. And then you hope that when you run that algorithm over unseen data, that it'll sort of look for those patterns and then will accurately classify the speech as a human might. And, you know, our classifiers to date, our accuracy ranges between the type of classifier, but it can range from anything from 0.8 to sort of 0.95, which means it's, you know, 95% as good as a human would be. And even humans are not perfect when it comes to classifying text. So, you know, we're quite happy to make the sacrifice in accuracy, knowing full well that not every human would agree. And at the same time, the benefit of doing this is that we can actually analyze hundreds of millions of posts in the fraction of a time it would take human beings to do it. And that's something that was a huge learning curve for me and my social science team. But it's kind of transformed the way in which we work and approach criminological research, certainly in this field.
Fascinating. How big are they when you're training? So the four researchers who are be sitting in a windowless office. What's the normal training data set size? How many posts would they need to analyze?
At a minimum, usually around about we've trained on 4,000 at a minimum. So that's usually the classes. You try to get them balanced, so you get 2,000 hate speech and 2,000 non-hate speech. But sometimes there's the argument that, well, actually in the real world, so to speak, there isn't half of social media isn't full of hate speech. You know, so it's like 1% of social media traffic's hate speech. So there's some arguments out there that those data sets should be also imbalanced in the training process. But with so few data points, then that becomes really problematic. So we do try to boost the yes class as much as we can. But that said, I mean, the more data, the better, as usual. So with some exercises, I've seen as many as 20,000 posts annotated. It depends on the resources, obviously, but also how you go about the annotating. So you can actually, traditionally you can get folks sat in a room and, coding on an iPad or something, or you can use something like Amazon Mechanical Turk, which is more like a crowdsourcing platform whereby you can distribute the work over actually hundreds of annotators, but they're probably somewhere in another part of the world. And so they may not be native English speakers, and you can't check the credentials of the annotator. So you lose some quality potentially in the annotation by doing that. But yeah, it's annotation is a big business, actually. If you think about the number of times a big tech company needs data annotated by a human to train their classifiers, and they have loads and loads of these classifiers. There's a lot of money being made out there in the space of annotation, which is interesting because I feel like social scientists kind of created the annotation business with this kind of code and retrieve technique with qualitative data. And now it's being done on this kind of industrial scale to help the big social media companies refine their products and, well, ultimately make money, I guess.
Talking about social media companies, you've talked about these massive data sets. Where do they come from?
Yes, so it's interesting because not every social media company is generous with their data. So most of our research and most of folks that do this kind of work is done on Twitter. So most of it is on Twitter because they give away their data for free, especially for not-for-profit academic work. They've changed their program over the years in terms of how they kind of provide these data and the quality and the volume of data they give to academics. And I think currently the product they have is pretty good. It's called the Academic Track, where you can apply for a project via their website, the developer website, and kind of give them a rationale as to what the project's about. And then they will either agree it or not and sort of give you a 10 million a month limit of free data, which is usually more than enough for the average academic project. And that's how we access Twitter data. We also do access other types of data, especially in HateLab. So we've got engineers who have built tools to scrape 4chan, Telegram, and Reddit. Now, they have APIs, but they're not as easy to access as Twitter data. And you do need some of that technical expertise to build the interface to pull that data down. But Twitter have made it very easy for the average social scientist to now get data. So if you are a social scientist and you're interested in looking, say, at data that's already kind of out there, you can go to something called the Twitter Downloader, which is basically a very simple interface which allows you to put in a query. It gives you an estimate how many data points will be generated by that query, and then you can just click download, and you get this kind of CSV file of tweets with all the metadata associated with that tweet. All those tweets, and that's ready for analysis. So it is an Apache ecosystem in that sense. Facebook data is almost impossible to get, as is Instagram. I think Facebook got really conscious of it after Cambridge Analytica, because of course their data were, they would say, being misused, and they completely locked off all access more or less after that to academics, it seems. Google data, again, they're not necessarily very generous with it either. You can kind of build scrapers to pull, say, comments off of YouTube videos. There are methods for doing that. But Twitter seemed to be the most generous in terms of providing data really quite easily to academics. What you do with that data, once you've downloaded it, though, is a completely different question, because, of course, not every social scientist would be familiar with the kind of the format of the data and how you kind of then, say, transform it to use in, say, Stata or SPSS or even putting it into NVivo or Atlas TI. There are a few hoops to jump through before you get data that looks anything like what we're used to.
So it'll come in like a CSV file with the text, for example, of the tweet, the thing that we would see on our phones or on our computers, but what is the metadata involved?
There's about the tweet text is one field, and there's about 100 other fields beyond that, believe it or not. So there's actually a lot of information. So you get, for example, the unique tweet ID. So that's useful if you need to share your data. So Twitter don't like you sharing full data sets because they want to what they say, honor deletions. So, for example, if someone deletes their tweet after your collection, what you should do as a researcher is honor that deletion. It's really hard to do that with static data sets, though, so it doesn't tend to happen that routinely. So what Twitter do to kind of work around that is say, look, if you want to share your data, you should just share the tweet IDs. And so once you hand over those tweet IDs, you can then re-query the Twitter application program interface, and it will, what they call it, they rehydrate the content for you. But it will give you null returns for the deleted content. So that's a really good way of ensuring that the deletions are honored. So it's important to keep that tweet ID for archiving your data, say with the UK Data Service, if your project's funded by UKRI, for example. About every bit of data you can possibly imagine beyond that. So timestamp for when the tweet was posted, the timestamp for the last time it was retweeted, for example. So really useful for time series analysis, plotting time series, etc. Obviously the content of the tweets, as we've already mentioned, but also other things like the name of the tweeter, their handle, some statistics on their network, their number of followers and the number of tweets they've posted, when their first tweet. Everything you can possibly. So they're very generous with all this kind of metadata. And of course, when we first were confronted by it as social scientists, it took a bit of mental gymnastics to work out, well, how do I use these data? How am I going to analyze these data to say something about, you know, the social organization of Twitter users or social change or whatever it might be? And it took quite a few months of talking with computer scientists about how these data could be transformed, how we could derive, for example, useful information from the text using machine classifying techniques, but also, you know, topic clustering and LDA is another way of deriving summaries of qualitative data, which is so large that, you know, you can't see the wood through the trees. And it just applying those kinds of techniques to then derive new data or generate new variables. Based on that kind of stuff, we've been able to analyze, for example, how hate speech spread after an event. So we could classify content as hate speech or not, doing that kind of annotation and machine learning process I described. Then we could build sort of time series models that allow us to identify sort of the peak and the trough of the production of hate speech. Then we could model the enablers and inhibitors of that hate speech using the other variables that were derived from Twitter. And so using quite conventional social science statistics then, you know, basic sort of, I think it was, we did some sort of hazard modeling and we did just a basic negative binomial model sort of predicting who was most likely to produce hate speech. We were able to bring together the computer science machine learning, interesting stuff with the more conventional statistical model building that we do every day in social sciences to produce this really, what we found really interesting kind of take on how hate speech and when it's produced and by whom after a terror attack, and then for how long it lasts over time. And that allowed us to say, right, far-right groups are far more likely, no surprise there, to produce hate speech during the first 24 hours of a terror attack. But the hate speech that they produced wasn't really retweeted that much. It didn't gain much traction. And actually, it didn't last that long in the ecosystem. It tended to die out quite quickly. Whereas communications from the police in the aftermath of a terror attack there were more volume of them and they lasted longer. They were retweeted for a longer period of time. And, you know, it turned out that was actually quite useful to know for the authorities. You know, it's quite good to know that the police comms online get more traction than the hate speech does. We didn't know that before we had built those models. So, you know, I think we were quite successful in transforming those data into something that was usable, combining both the computer science and the social science techniques to generate some pretty useful kind of policy relevant findings. And we've subsequently done that across an array of events. We've done it with Brexit, for example, and hate speech that was produced following the Brexit vote. We've done it in relation to sporting tournaments. We did it in relation to, for example, the Euro 2020 final, where the three black players unfortunately missed those penalties, and we had a massive spike in hate speech following that. And we continue to do it in other contexts as well. So it's interesting stuff, and we were able to show that, you know, bringing those two fields together with using data like these can actually add some value and have some impact.
it's amazing how you can do that. To an extent, there's a sort of causal relationship that you can sort of model. Is there potential for prediction, do you think, in the future? Given the massive volume of data, it feels like prediction would be something possible here.
Yeah, that always feels like the holy grail of this stuff, doesn't it? You know, can we predict? I mean, the Home Office or any government department would be like, yeah, can you tell us what's going to happen in 2 weeks in relation? If you can count the amount of tweets in this area, you know, what does it mean for what might happen on the streets in 2 weeks' time? It's certainly something we've looked at. We were pretty interested in identifying, for example, whether tweets about crime and disorder in a particular area, so taking a sort of a broken windows sort of approach, you know, if more people are tweeting about broken windows indicators in a given location in London, and maybe talking a bit about fear of crime as well, if their fear was sort of heightened, did that correlate to crime on the streets? And that was our first foray into this kind of prediction space. So the models we built were descriptive. They weren't predictive in that sense, but you could extrapolate from those descriptive models and build a predictive system. And that's where the computer scientists actually love to kind of dabble. They love prediction, whereas I think in the social sciences, we're a bit more stuck in that kind of describing mode, which is equally as valuable, of course. But I think the computer scientists really want to get their hands on the prediction side of things. And I totally get that. But of course, you know, the ethics of doing this kind of work is always at the forefront of my mind. And, you know, even if we could build a predictive model, I'd kind of want to be really careful before it was kind of deployed. I mean, academically speaking, it's interesting and it's a really interesting exercise to do. But its implementation beyond the lab is always something we have to be really sort of careful about. So, yeah, we have found that there are links and patterns between what's said and posted online and what happens on the streets. And in London, we did that across the whole city. We've recently done it with hate speech to see if, for example, online hate speech targeting race and religion is predictive of hate crime on the streets with a lag of, say, a week or 2 weeks. And we did that at a lower super output area in London. So that was, you know, 4,800 geographical units. And we were able to get data from the Met Police on hate crimes at that level. And we were able to get data from Twitter at the same level. Add in a few control variables for good measure, you know, what else is correlated with hate, just so we can kind of rule that stuff out. And build some fixed effects models, random effects models, to see if there was a relationship. And we, like other research in other parts of the world, we did find a sort of a pattern. An increase in hate speech online did seem to correlate to some extent with an increase on the ground. Of course, because this is at the spatial level, we were shied away from saying there was any kind of causal link. But ultimately, you know, it's a step in that direction, I guess. And that work was actually kind of backed up with some work that was done in America and some stuff that was done in Germany. So the emerging pattern seems to be that, yes, there is this link between what happens online and what happens offline. I mean, at one point, that seemed like an outrageous thing to say, maybe even a few years ago. But now I think everyone's come around to the idea that, yeah, what's done online actually has consequence on people's lives. And I think it took a long time to get there, because I remember when I started out in this field, there was a lot of resistance to acknowledging that what happened online actually had any consequence beyond just that online community. And I think, thank goodness, we've actually changed the way we think about that now.
Do you think the relationship is that the people who are doing the act, the criminal behaviors, presumably they're like, it must be pretty hard to do a crime while also tweeting about it, like, but So I suppose the Twitter activity is like echoing the behavior, but they're not necessarily the same population or the same.
That's right. Yeah, that's our assumption, and that's the kind of that's the argument we make in the paper, is that indeed, there may be some people who are doing the tweeting are also doing the crime. So, for example, with the hate speech, it wouldn't be fanciful to think that a person who is tweeting pretty racist stuff on Twitter might not, in a few days' time, shout something on a bus to an immigrant, for example. I mean, that could happen. But for the most part, the assumption was that these two things could also be separate mechanisms, and the online tension, which is obviously shared potentially between folks in an area, is potentially a reflection of what's going on the streets. And it's just kind of a like an echo of what's happening. And we're picking up that kind of echo on social media before something actual happens on the streets. But there is this kind of interrelationship, and it's not just one direction. The chances are it's bidirectional. And what we're getting is this kind of feedback between the two settings, and that we're just at the point that we collect our data and measure, we're picking up this kind of echo. There's a lot more work to be done there to disentangle that kind of relationship, but there is something going on there. And what those mechanisms look like at the individual level, yeah, that's the tricky part, because we don't get the data at that level, which is the problem.
So this method and this approach to understanding the social world through the online world, how has that been received by other criminologists?
I think like most academic fields, it's, you know, criminology is still quite traditional. So, and, you know, academics have long careers, if they're lucky, I suppose. And so we have a lot, we have, you know, generations of criminologists who honed their skills, you know, in the 60s and 70s, right? So, and they're still, and we look up to these criminologists because they've had stunning, stellar careers, and they taught us how to become criminologists, right? And some of them are open to this stuff and they're kind of excited by it. Others, I think, are a bit more reticent to kind of engage. I think partly because it's a whole new kind of set of skills that they'd have to pick up in order to fully comprehend and then criticize what's going on. So I think there is this kind of, I'm just not going to go there because, you know, it would just take too much of my, and I feel that now with my PhD students, you know, they're doing things in their PhDs that is just way beyond my capability. So, you know, I'm reading their stuff and sometimes I'm having to trust that what they've done is right, but I'll call in the expertise of somebody else just to look over a part of the thesis that I don't fully understand. But I guess that we're doing that all the time. I think there is this, there has been this kind of sea change or this kind of acceleration of change, and the inclusion of tech and tech methods in the discipline has kind of sped up that need to, or possible need to retrain. You know, it's like retaking your driving test when you're in your 80s or something, right? Just to make sure you're still safe. You know, I'm not sure if we're going to get to that point or something similar in criminal or the social sciences or the sciences more generally. But it certainly feels as if it's a bit different than from when I was doing my master's and PhD.
Do you think then maybe the era of like the lone researcher might be over? Certainly in this field, that you need an interdisciplinary team, you need computer scientists and social scientists working together. Is that a necessary condition?
That's how I did it. I mean, I had to partner up with the computer scientists so we could get code written, software engineered to do what we did. But what I'm finding with my PhD students now is that they're able to fulfill both those roles, actually. So, you know, most of my PhDs now are able to use R, stats package. Within that, they're able to do a bit of coding, and they're starting to learn how to do topic modeling. They're starting to learn how to do machine learning. And fair enough, they might have a proclivity towards that kind of work anyway. But I think if you've got an interest in, say, statistics, and that you've got a passion even for statistics, and your brain works in that way, and you can pick that up quite quickly, then it's not much of a leap for you to then start thinking about programming. It's the same kind of set of logic and thought processing, and it doesn't take too much of a leap to get there. So with our students, we're really encouraging them to get their hands dirty with this stuff, because not everyone can create and form a team. It's really hard. Interdisciplinary teams are really hard to establish, and even harder to kind of keep together. Myself and Pete Burnett, the computer scientist, have been very lucky in that we actually quite like each other as people, right? So that, and we've become very close friends, actually. You know, he came to my wedding and we have him around for barbecues and stuff. So we're really close on that level. So that really helps the collaboration. And even if there's kind of frustration or misunderstandings, we get over that quite quickly because we are socially, you know, very, very friendly. Without that, I think it can be more difficult because academics have in different fields have different priorities. So, for example, computer scientists are obsessed with prediction, whereas we're obsessed with explaining things and describing things. And if you need to kind of appreciate both to do this kind of work, they want to publish in highly technical computer science journals for the research excellence framework. We want to publish in top social science journals. So you've got to come to some kind of agreement on what you do there. You know, do you publish the same thing in two different outlets? Is that the wrong thing to do? how much do you have to change that publication before it doesn't look like you've plagiarized yourself for two different outlets? Will the Research Excellence Framework panels, you know, accept a publication from me if it's not published in a social science journal, but it's published in like IEEE Transactions on, you know, Computational Social Systems or something, you know? And so the discipline as a whole has a long way to go, or the disciplines have a long way to go into kind of really accepting interdisciplinary work and where it can appear. But it's a challenge, to say the least. So if you can do it on your own, I guess you're way more independent. You're not dependent on anybody else to do work for you, and you can publish where the hell you want. And you can also then, of course, decide where you want to be employed. So you could easily be employed in the School of Social Science, or you could actually be employed in the School of Computer Science. And I've seen that, you know, very technical social scientists getting jobs in social computing. Because they can actually publish in those journals, you know, and they can carve a career out there instead. So,
or even outside academia, actually.
If you want to chase the money, then you can get, if you've got the skills required to kind of analyze these data, then yeah, you are in high demand in industry too. So I've seen some students go into industry and, you know, earn double what a professor can earn. Yeah, and they're only in their 30s. But that's industry for you. But they do also work you like a dog. So it's kind of, and we work hard, I know that. But at the same time, you know, working in industry, you're not necessarily working on the thing you want to work on. And that's the beauty of being an academic. Very often you can choose what you want to work on. But, you know, that's the difference. That's the reason the salary's higher.
Just as a final question, it's been a really interesting sort of journey through your career and through the research methods. So hopefully, if anyone listens to this podcast, there'll be a few people who are interested in getting into this sort of area themselves. And you've given a few tips and ideas so far. But is there anything you'd say to a sort of master's student who's interested in either studying hate crime or using big data to understand social processes? Where should they start? What advice would you say, looking back over your career, what's the advice that you would maybe give your younger self, or what you would give to a fledgling researcher?
There's always the traditional route in academia, and that's to find a supervisor that does this kind of stuff and ask them to supervise you. I mean, that usually helps quite a bit because, of course, then you can draw upon all the resources and the information that person has, and there's a few of us out there doing this kind of work. So I think, you know, if someone wants to do a PhD in this area, is find the right place and the right supervisor is key, I think. But if it's, say, more to do with like doing a master's dissertation, then, you know, there are great resources out there on how to kind of do this stuff. I think for the most part, if you think about code and coding and accessing algorithms and data, compared to when I started out, there's now a huge amount of information out there that's already prepackaged and ready to kind of deploy. So, you know, you can look at something like GitHub, which stores a lot of code and data in relation to this kind of stuff. And, you know, if you can think about it, if you can think about a method or a way of analyzing data, then the chances are someone's written a package for that out there. And that's great. And the fact that you can kind of teach yourself this stuff with access to those resources, and also, you know, online courses, of which there are now an abundance, YouTube videos, loads of YouTube videos on how to do this stuff too. So it's great that that's all out there. And I think there's also software. We've developed some software called Cosmos, for example, that allows undergrads and master's students to simply sort of access and download Twitter data and then visualize it in very simplistic ways. And that's a great kind of sort of gateway into this realm. And if students wanted to find that, it's on the Social Data Science Lab website and they can download it for free. But there's other programs too. You've got Node Excel that allows you to kind of download similar kinds of data and do some network analysis. So there's a lot more software out there now that wasn't available when I started out that will allow students to dabble, you know. But then if that dabbling gets into a more serious interest, then yeah, I think the more traditional way of finding that school and that supervisor with some interest or expertise in this area is probably the best way about it.
Fantastic. Matt, absolute pleasure talking to you. Thank you very much for being our second guest on our second podcast. Some fantastic, fascinating research is only going to go from strength to strength, I imagine. But thank you very much for being on the show.
Thanks for inviting me. Thank you.
Cheers.